Well, no rats raining from the sky in Washington, D.C. last week when I was there for the climate summit, but it was raining and the weather was kind of weird. I arrived Wednesday evening for this summit on Thursday, May 23rd, and it was about 88 degrees, hot and humid. And when I left Friday afternoon, 48 hours later, it was rainy and cloudy and about 58 degrees or maybe even less than that. So climate change, global weirding alive and well in our nation's capital and across the country on this day as we speak. We have more tornado and twister warnings in the part of the country that is prone to that. So it seems we cannot escape our increasingly more drastic weather, and that's part of what we talk about here on this program and make the connections between that and the greenhouse gases we are spewing. Well, I am very happy to have on the program my occasional co-host, D.R. Tucker. As I was traveling to that summit last week, we did a rerun, and so next week I'll be away again while my daughter graduates from high school, so great to have this live show on. We're going to be talking about the summit as much as I'm able to. So, hey, D.R.
Yes, how are you doing?
Good. You know a little bit about what happened last week. I am not at liberty to share as much as I had hoped. Apparently, it was an event that I was very pleased and honored to be part of, the first ever White House Women's Leadership Conference on Climate and Energy. But it was not, you know, open to the press. It was not going to be covered in any official way. I was really invited, I learned later, as an individual climate activist. And, of course, I wear several hats, that of a former CBS journalist turned environmental radio host turned green activist, climate change advocate, advocate, of course, for awareness and action on the biggest threat to our future ever. And so they asked me to please not reveal specifics, but I can talk about it in a general way, and I am going to be playing in just a couple minutes. We'll be hearing comments from our newly installed and had been about 24 hours new last Thursday, our new energy secretary, to hear what he had to say about the administration's top priorities. So we'll hear that in just a couple minutes, but just wanted to check in with you, DR, first and see what's top of mind for you. You've been sending out some emails the last 24 hours. Michelle Bachmann, one of the things that caught your attention?
Yes, and it's great to speak to you. You know, listening to that intro from our friends Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, you know, it reminds us that with all the talk about rats dropping, you sure don't want to see any sort of Mickey Mouse efforts being made to combat climate change. You want real efforts. But granted, that's a lame joke, but still. In any event, yes, I woke to the news that Michelle Bachmann, who's been a member of the 6th District in Minnesota since 2007, is now announced that she will not run for an additional term in 2014. Michelle Bachmann was famous for, among other things, her vehement denials of the risks of the greenhouse gas emissions. And in April 2009, as another friend of ours, Brad Johnson of Forecast the Facts, noted, in April 2009, she declared that the Waxman-Markey bill to combat greenhouse gas emissions was nothing more than cap and tax, and that CO2 was a quote-unquote natural byproduct of nature, which was a harmless gas, and therefore there was no need to regulate it. So it seems that she knows about as much about science as she does about legislating, which turns out not to be much, and I do not think that she will be missed. There was a comment on the Politico, the first comment on the Politico website reporting this said, "Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you," and I certainly agree with those sentiments.
And I'm chuckling, but there's nothing funny about people in office who don't believe in climate change and actively want to propagate, you know, doubt on the science that is more than, you know, definitive. Maybe she'll go back to raising her, she has a quiver of kids, and she doesn't, I guess, have any concern about their future as it relates to extreme weather and climate. I couldn't help but note that when the Today Show, which is my morning fix, did a story about her stepping down, the next story, the very next story, was wild weather continues across America. You know, it just can't help. When you see the world through green lenses as we do, we just cannot escape the irony that is ever more apparent.
And you know, another famous quote from Michelle Bachmann is her quote in 2011 that she would never vote to increase the debt ceiling. Well, when she voted against the Waxman-Markey bill, she certainly voted to increase the carbon ceiling. And what's going to be worse for our country, the debt ceiling or the carbon ceiling, now that we've hit 400 parts per million?
Exactly. As we talked about months ago, there's the fiscal cliff and then there's the climate cliff. funny we haven't heard much about the fiscal cliff. It kind of goes in and out, you know, with the issue du jour. But of course, we still have major financial challenges and haven't even begun to chip away at the climate challenge. While I was traveling last Thursday at that summit, which we'll talk about in just a second, I was very pleased to see that our Governor Jerry Brown, as I'm sure you noticed, was giving the news media some well-deserved criticism for ignoring climate change. And we had hoped to get him on today's show. We're going to try again in a couple weeks because it was kind of a last-minute request. But I just, you know, really respect him for being pretty consistent. He's certainly been a consistent, you know, green leader on all issues. But he's been talking about fuel efficiency and climate change since his first administration. But he took the opportunity to speak in Mountain View and Silicon Valley to really say that he says, if you take a look at Google and type in global warming news, I venture to say on most days, 20 to 30%, if not more, of the news will be by climate deniers or skeptics, whatever you want to call them. He said that at NASA's Ames Research Center, he said, everything these guys are saying is either not true, not relevant, or totally distorted, or it's not important. He went on to say that people must, quote, join with other individuals and organizations to spread information about climate change and work to combat it. Well, of course, you can probably predict that right about now we'd say, wouldn't a nationally syndicated daily show that talks about these issues help put these challenges on the map?
It's interesting that that Jerry Brown made those observations, and I would love to see sort of like a joint event where the current governor of California and the former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, use their voices collectively to press for more climate coverage. And it's also interesting that this occurs so recently after CBS News broke the Sunday morning show Climate Silence by doing a tremendous segment on the risks that we're facing with no deniers, no so-called skeptics, a 14 minutes of actual straight science. I watched it 10 times over the course of the past few days because it was just an extraordinary thing to see, and to see Bob Schieffer, the anchor of CBS Face the Nation, you know, engaged with the science, curious about the science, asking probing questions. And, you know, it's been so long since the mainstream media has covered climate and environmental issues generally so extensively that it seems like a new story. It's like they're talking about something brand new when it's been an issue for at least 25 to 30 years in terms of the growing risks. So you know, hats off to CBS News for doing that segment, and hopefully ABC and NBC will follow up with their own segments on their Sunday morning newscasts.
Right, and my favorite comment was from Dr. Heidi Cullen, who said, you know, if we procrastinate, it will only get worse. And certainly we are procrastinating. I want to mention that today there will be some XL climate activists greeting President Obama at a stop in Chicago. That's going to happen in a couple of hours. And then tomorrow there's also a demonstration planned in California against fracking. So the issue of fracking is very much alive and well. And yet, I don't know, DR, if you saw the latest research from Yale, our friends there, mm-hmm. Anthony Lazarowitz, they found that majority of Americans are not even really aware fracking is an issue and therefore have not really formed an opinion, which shouldn't surprise listeners to this show because we're constantly saying, you know, Americans really are not tuned into their environment, really not paying attention to this. And how would they really know? Where would they? I mean, yes, it's in the newspaper more, and it's, you know, even on some of the commercial broadcast stations that we've been trying to, you know, get a place on. But it's not, you know, like we activists who are constantly worried about this stuff and reading in our inbox every day what's happening, and, you know, what's happening if we don't pay attention in terms of the spread of fracking before there's really enough research done on the health and environmental impacts. One of the questions that came up at the climate summit last Thursday was, you know, how it, from the audience, about 100 women from, you know, mostly the nonprofit sector, I would say, but some government, some corporate representatives as well. One of the women, one of the more vocal sort of agitators, I say that very affectionately, who kept talking about where's the urgency, I believe it was her, who asked, you know, how is it that fracking got a green light from the government, you know, so quickly? And there was some scattered light applause from a few corners in the audience to that question.
It's not a surprise that there would be so much you know, lack of interest in the risks of fracking because of the amount of disinformation that's out there about fracking. You know, I often read the well, not just often on a daily basis, I took the Albany Times Union, because in Albany, New York, and in New York State generally, there's a huge controversy over fracking, and there's this inundation of letters to the editor from fracking advocates saying, oh, it's not that harmful, oh, you know, people might be, you know, exaggerating the risks to their drinking water as a result of fracking. So the industry that makes a lot of money off fracking is very, very aggressive in sort of pushing the idea that it's not that much of a risk. We're both aware of the commercials from one of the major oil companies basically saying, hey, you know, natural gas, 50% less, you know, greenhouse gas emissions than coal. Well, you hear those commercials and say to yourself, how about developing an energy source that has no greenhouse gas emissions, that is actually safe for the climate? So it's not a surprise that people are not as troubled by fracking as those who cover the issue and focus on the issue more intensely.
I want to just give a few details about their findings, and then we'll try to get someone from the Yale School of Climate Change and Communication on in 2 weeks from now. Some of the key findings: support or opposition to hydraulic fracturing varies by gender, age, political party, that's not surprising, geographic region, and familiarity with the issue. General respondents who are female, younger, and liberal are more opposed. Those who are male, older, and conservative, more supportive, not surprising either. Americans who support hydraulic fracturing or fracking associate it with economic and energy supply impacts. Opponents, however, associate it with environmental impacts. Again, not surprising, but we're going to drill down, get someone on to talk a little bit more about, you know, how can we educate more Americans so that if, you know, we make a decision either way, it is an informed decision and not just one that the oil and coal and gas industry continues to get away with because most Americans are not paying attention.
And note the parallel between the demographics supporting versus opposing fracking, the demographics supporting versus opposing the Keystone XL pipeline. It's sort of like there's this overlap between where you stand on the ideological scale and where you stand on the energy scale. Very interesting.
Yeah, it becomes continues to be a political issue, not a practical one, with our future, you know, top of mind. It's all about what's most expedient for those special interests, and hate to say it, but greed seems to be at play here much more so than just being grounded about the realities of continuing to, you know, suck the life out of Mother Earth, our life support system, and to continue to try to have a symbiotic, you know, coexistence would be the wise conservative approach, and yet that seems to be overlooked too often.
It's amazing how, you know, It's considered to be conservative to not conserve the Earth, not conserve the planet. That, you know, that seems to be the radical approach. Fracking, you would figure, would be seen as something radical and not something that conservatives would embrace. But again, there's a wide gulf, no pun intended, between the actual terms being used and what the terms mean politically and ecologically.
And speaking of bridging the Gulf, this is probably as good a moment as any to just chat a little bit about my overall impressions from the summit at the White House. First of all, it wasn't actually at the White House. It was just across the street in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. It is where the federal offices are housed, so it was not that it wasn't exactly, you know, what they billed it as, but it wasn't, you know, like in the West Wing, but across the street from the West Wing. So that's the first thing I want to just shed some light on. Also, it was, I don't know if it was a summit, you know, it was a day-long conference. Summit probably raised expectations, at least on my part, perhaps a little more than would have indicated by the title. But let's give them credit, the Obama administration and the environmental officials in his cabinet, for holding the first ever, not only first ever summit on climate change with women, but really having the new energy secretary, who had been installed just about 24 hours, start off the event. He kicked it off, Ernest Moniz. We're going to hear his comments for our audience. You'll get to hear him for about 10 minutes in just a moment, so stay tuned for that. Hasn't been publicized anywhere else yet. And then other impressions were, you know, good for the administration for holding this. We heard from Nancy Sutley. She's the chair of the Council on Environmental Quality. That's an entity that I've never quite understood exactly what they do, other than they're there. They work on environmental issues, but we don't seem to hear from them too much. The first panel, there were two panels during the day. The first one was on climate science and energy solutions. The first speaker was very impressive. She was Dr. Kathy Sullivan. I don't know if you remember DR, but she was an astronaut, and she also was the first woman to ever walk in space, so she has that historical distinction. She is currently the acting administrator of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and she talked about how viewing Mother Earth from, you know, up in space changed her view forever of how delicate the atmosphere is and how much we have to do to protect, you know, this delicate balance. Kateri Callahan, she was probably my favorite speaker. She's the president of the Alliance to Save Energy, and she just spoke about how much more we could be doing in terms of energy efficiency. And you know me, DR, and anyone who listens to the show knows I hate waste more than anything, and it's the sort of oblivious wasting of resources, including especially energy, that really drives me nuts, because we need it and we're going to need it, and future generations are going to curse us for not being more judicious or conservative with this limited resource. And then the second panel, finish my wrap-up, and then I'd love your comments or questions, climate and energy communication in action. And, of course, that's what I was really most looking forward to. And that was started off by Cecilia Estolano. She was really on fire, very passionate speaker that kind of woke up the crowd, a little bit of, you know, more of an activist feel to it. She's the founder of Estolano Lazar Perez Advisors, and she talked a lot about what's going on with solar energy and in underserved communities, and a lot of interesting, exciting things there. And then my friend, Reverend Sally Bingham, of course, president of the Regeneration Project, Interfaith Power and Light. She really moved the audience there, everyone really in the room, including administration officials, with the call, you know, to look at the morality of what we're doing or not doing, to look at the ethics of addressing climate change and energy efficiency and resource conservation. And then also on that panel was Frances Beinecke. She, of course, is the president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, also giving an impassioned plea to, you know, communicate and educate Americans and to reach out on a broader scale. Of course, that speaks to my green heart. And then we heard from Heather Zeichel. I'm still not sure exactly the correct pronunciation, but she is the president's point person on climate change, deputy assistant to the president for energy and climate change. She was also very impressive and seemed to really get it. So it's good to know she's there in that important position. And then there was more, but some breakout sessions. And then it was wrapped up, the whole event, by a woman, young woman named Katie Walsh, who's a recent college graduate, and she talked about the need to, you know, sort of in a very polite way, you know, question the status quo, to follow one's instincts if one feels that we are not on the right path. I think she was, you know, really addressing young people with the message to lean in, you know, care about this stuff. It's going to affect your future. And then we had a nice reception at a bar at which we had the most interesting conversations. If only I hadn't had a few glasses of wine and I could remember them better. So that's my wrap-up.
It sounds like a terrific event. Interesting that it was a few days afterwards that Politico did a story, you know, asking where is Obama's climate agenda? And, you know, we go back to that famous line that was attributed to FDR, to FDR telling activists, you know, I want to do this, but you have to make me do this. And hopefully that event will be sort of one of the many factors that sort of make, that sort of compel Obama to sort of, you know, find his backbone on this issue, because you get the sense that, sometimes you get the sense that after confronting the power of the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry, you try to see, you know, does he still have that power? Does he still have that willingness to confront the fossil fuel industry? And it will take, obviously, just a tremendous amount of courage to do so. And I think there's a sense that he needs to see that there are millions of Americans who are willing to support him if he decides to, in the remaining years of his presidency, confront the fossil fuel industry and the forces of denial and disinformation. So if that event, you know, serves as a sort of burr in his saddle to take the actions he needs to protect not just future generations, present generations, then that will be all to the good.
Exactly. And I did ask a question when Heather was on the podium. I asked her, wouldn't it help the president to help educate Americans if we had some, you know, programming in, you know, commercial mainstream broadcast, in particular radio or television, where there's, you know, a mass audience already tuned in for news or issue-oriented programming. And she agreed that, yes, that could be helpful, and she directed me to talk to someone about that afterwards, which I did, and, you know, got connected with a couple of people who may or may not be helpful in, you know, our efforts to try to make that happen.
It definitely needs to be a part of any sort of real and effective climate effort to sort of broaden the knowledge base of the American public. I mean, you know, segments on CBS News are great, segments on MSNBC are great, segments on current TV are great, segments on NBC News when they talk about this are great, because they did a segment recently, you know, talking about the effect of man-made climate change on the current weather patterns. But it has to be consistent, and it has to be comprehensive, and it has to be compelling in order to sort of drive the message home that this is something that all Americans, regardless of ideology, regardless of background, need to come together and, you know, combat that, you know, in order for us to be on what Joe Rome calls a World War II footing to address climate change, we all have to be in this together, we all have to be engaged, and the media, you know, communications, it plays such a critical role in sort of, you know, raising awareness. You go back 50 years, you know how Bill McKibben always talks about, you know, this is our Selma and Stonewall moment. Well, how would the civil rights movement have become successful were it not for those images that we all remember of the dogs and the hoses being turned on civil rights activists? It was those images that galvanized people to action, and it will be the images that you'd see on television and you hear on radio and you see in your newspapers of the risks of the problems that will galvanize people to action. But you have to see those images, you have to hear the words, you have to read the science in order to be galvanized, and that is something that absolutely has to be a constant presence in the mainstream media.
Hear. And let's hear the words now. Let's listen to our new Department of Energy, Dr. Ernest Moniz. These were his opening comments at the White House Summit last Thursday.
I think we turn to the current challenges and the president's as already stated, the president's very, very strong commitment to clean energy, a low-carbon economy, and addressing the risks of climate change. And frankly, this is the reason why I came back to town. I mean, there's lots of challenges at DOE, but this is an overarching one for our society, and the opportunity to help the president in this was just one that could not be passed up. So the president, you know, I think, you know, if you kind of talk about a string of relevant to this discussion, objectives, of course, you know, the economy and jobs is critical, climate critical, clean tech is critical, reduced oil dependence is critical, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about the agenda as to how all these things come together in ways that reinforce our approach to the climate challenge. I will note that in his second inaugural address, one quote, the president said, "We the people still believe that our obligations as Americans are not just to ourselves, but to all posterity. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations." In that context, I like to say that I'm not here to debate what's not debatable. The threat from climate change is real and urgent. The science fully demands a prudent response. Just this month, as you know, I mean, it's kind of symbolically hitting essentially 400 ppm CO2. Of course, that's not including the non-CO2 greenhouse gases, which really pump you up to about 450 in effect. So we really need to get after this. It's an important imperative. Now the question is, what are the solutions? And this is where there is, in fact, now what I would call legitimate debate. Let's debate the solutions as opposed to the driver. So again, economy and jobs, climate, clean tech, reduced oil dependence. Let me say a little bit about some of the areas that we intend to emphasize at the department over the next 3.5 years, roughly. We're going to start with energy efficiency, classic win-win-win situation, an area that we certainly intend to try to amplify the efforts of the department and the administration with a strong full-court press. And I think we look to do this kind of, you know, across the board. It's in appliance standards, it's in buildings, it's in industrial processes, it's in vehicles, and maybe just say a few words about those. I mean, appliance standards, the standards put in place in the last 4 years are projected to save almost $2 trillion over 20 years. It's important, but there's a lot more sitting there in the queue. We all know that we need to kind of accelerate the pace getting these out, and that's something that we are certainly going to work very, very hard at. In terms of buildings, just yesterday we were able to put out the scorecard on the Better Buildings Challenge, working with our partners in the commercial and industrial arenas to go after the president's goal of a 20% reduction beyond baseline by 2020, and the partners are reporting in we're on track. I mean, it's we got to keep at it. We can't relax, but we're kind of on track. You go to the industrial arena. President has put forward a manufacturing initiative. Department of Energy is one player in that. And you know, this sounds potentially like I'm reverting to MIT scientist mode in talking about high band gap semiconductors for power electronics. But when you think that through, with success in that area, big efficiency implications in our energy system. Then you go to vehicles. Of course, the president already has the very strong fuel economy standards for 2025, which will have major implications. But I'm just going to use that now to pivot away from efficiency to the vehicle sector and reducing oil dependence, which of course has three major components: efficiency, which we've discussed. Secondly, alternative fuels. Could be using our natural gas resources that we have, advanced biofuels, et cetera. And third, electrification. And that's the one that I'll mention because yesterday, again, I think a very important announcement when Tesla fully repaid its loan. You know, it's a lot of money. We're talking about, you know, approaching $500 million, way ahead of schedule. A great success story, 3,000 jobs in Tesla. Export markets developing, Consumer Reports, best car they ever reviewed, not best electric vehicle, best car they ever reviewed, Motor Trend, Car of the Year. And we know this program has been maligned in some ways, and there have been, of course, as you would expect, in a high-risk portfolio, some companies that didn't make it. But the fact is that the legislated loan loss reserve is probably going to be used up at about the 10% level. So that's pretty good, I think, indication. So we've got to keep at it, and we will. But again, I think this is an example of a great success story in terms of getting a real lift with a company like this. And it fits into a theme, frankly, with what the president has done in general with the auto industry. You know, people forget in 2009, the word toast was often used in the context of the auto industry. Today we have a healthy industry. Ford, also with one of a very large loan that's led to retooling in many states for new technologies, all the way to Tesla with obviously groundbreaking technologies. A really different picture in three or 4 years. So that's just one kind of example there, and again, we're going to keep working at this kind of innovation. The Tesla story is a great one for the economy and jobs part, for the clean tech part, for the reduced oil dependence part. But what about the climate part? Well, that just tells us now we got to go back to the issue of decarbonizing the electricity sector. And we've seen in these 4 years a doubling of renewables in deployment. The president is committed to doubling that again in these next years up to 2020. You know, we've had this tremendous boon, part of the president's all the above strategy, if you like, this to embrace the way the natural gas revolution has really changed the face of the energy scene here. We know it's been a significant contributor to the decreased CO2 emissions over these last years. A very, very important bridge in this context to a low carbon future. But the key is we have to use the time that we have during this bridge period to really push on the development of the technologies so that they are ready for getting out there at very, very large scale. That's what we're doing. The president's budget for 2014 certainly aligns very, very well with that strong push of clean energy. Secretary Chu, I think, did a terrific job in some sense literally changing the face of technology innovation at DOE, ARPA-E being the most known example. But in addition, we tend to forget back in 2009, using quite a bit of recovery money, the Energy Frontier Research Centers were established. These are terrific. Innovation hubs are going out there. So I think, you know, the department is really going also after new models of innovation, and we're going to build on that and do more. I won't go into detail here, but for example, those of you, the aficionados who read PCAST reports religiously, can go back to December 2010 and look at a report that recommended a quadrennial energy review, and that's a process to really lead to a new way of integrating all these threads.
I hope you agree. That is our newly installed U.S. Secretary of Energy, Dr. Ernest Moniz. He is talking about what the administration is committed to doing. We will see. Quick impressions, DR, then we've got to close out this segment and get on with the show. We've got a couple other great short segments coming up.
Yes, well, he definitely seems to be engaged with efforts to sort of pursue a clean energy future. The only caveat I had was that when he mentioned that line that always sort of grates on people for justifiable reason, the all of the above strategy, which I think it was Brad Johnson that once called it an oil above all strategy. And you know, how can one simultaneously pursue in all the above strategy when all the science is saying that you have to keep as much of the coal and oil and gas in the ground as possible? It's just one of those things where you say, you know, it sounds great, and then something just hits your ear the wrong way. And when he used that line, it was like, oh boy.
I know. Well, that, you know, just to sum up, that was kind of my impression of the whole summit without going into detail, which I'm not really at liberty to do. There were some encouraging signs and some things I heard that were not exactly what those who lose sleep at night worried about, you know, climate and what's happening to our planet, you know, would be placated by, but more, you know, saying we need to take, you know, more urgent action. But hey, it's a start. Let's be grateful that the administration held this event, and the most promising thing, they promised to have us back next year to talk about progress. So hopefully it's opening up a communication, a dialogue that I think can only be positive. Thanks so much for joining me, DR. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about how kids can get outdoors to enjoy the wild, especially in underserved communities. And then we're going to get a quick glimpse into the San Francisco Green Film Festival kicking off this week. We'll be right back.